headlines. Iran offers its assessment of the European Union's draft proposal to revive the 2015 nuclear agreement, saying it is now awaiting the U.S. response. The Syrian military says it has targeted Turkey's bases in the northern part of the country after earlier Turkish airstrikes killed three Syrian soldiers. And Tunisia's new constitution comes into effect as the opposition cries foul, saying it unravels the country's democratic gains. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran has provided the European Union with its final conclusion on the bloc proposal for the revival of the 2015 agreement. Tehran is now awaiting the response from the bloc, which acts as a coordinator for the JCPOA revival talks. Iran's foreign minister earlier said that he sees no obstacle in the deal if the national red lines are respected. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said Washington must show flexibility and adopt a realistic approach if it's serious about reviving the nuclear agreement. Based on the EU proposed text, Amir Abdullahian said, it would not be the end for the world if the U.S. fails to do so. He warned that Iran has its own plan B if the talks don't result in an agreement.
They talk about plan B. We also have our own plan B, but we believe that in the end, this matter should be resolved with the realistic approach of all parties through negotiations.
The EU now says it is examining Tehran's response. The U.S. has also said it has received Iran's response and is studying it. Last week, the European Union put forth what it called the final text for the revival of the 2015 agreement. The deal was thrown into chaos after the U.S. pulled out of it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. The remaining signatories have been engaged in talks in Vienna since April last year to revive the accord. Abbas Aslani is a research fellow at the Center for Middle East Strategic Studies in Tehran. He explains Iran's stance in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal.
Well, Iran's current administration has been saying that its foreign policy does not rely only on the JCPOA. And Iranian president in his first press conference said that Iranian foreign policy under his administration will not start from the JCPOA, and it will not be limited to the nuclear deal. It means that Iran also sees other alternatives and options in order to improve its foreign relations with other countries. And we have been seeing that in the past, let's say, months or in the past year, in the tenure of the current Iranian president, Iran has been trying to engage in economic cooperation with neighboring countries or regional countries and to somehow find opportunities for more trade, let's say, engagements with other countries. In case that there is no agreement, Tehran, what is arguing is that it will try to continue to find new opportunities independent of the nuclear deal. However, it will not ignore this chance of the negotiations in order to lift the sanctions. You know, there's the argument that the nuclear deal or reviving the deal is not the, let's say, the panacea to the problems in the country. But what is needed is the, trying to find those potentials in order to increase the level of, let's say, trade volume with other countries.
Syrian media say Turkey has carried out deadly airstrikes on the Arab country. Three military personnel have been killed. Turkish warplanes targeted military positions on the outskirts of Aleppo. Six soldiers were also injured. Military sources say the strikes were part of Turkey's long-running efforts in support of terrorist groups in northern Syria. The Syrian army responded by targeting Turkish bases inside Syria. The army also targeted the positions of armed groups and damaged their training centers. Syrian military sources say any attack on Syrian army's position by Turkey will not go unanswered. Over a dozen diplomats have visited Gaza to assess the humanitarian situation in the blockaded coastal territory following a recent Israeli military aggression. More details by Ashraf Shana.
Diplomats from the European Union, including heads of European diplomatic missions in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, arrived in Gaza Tuesday morning. The senior European officials toured the Shati refugee camp upon arriving in the blockaded territory. Their short visit comes less than 2 weeks after the Israeli regime launched a three-day military aggression on Gaza that claimed the lives of 49 people, including 17 children.
We come here only 10 days after the ceasefire has been agreed. A ceasefire which gave end to 3 days of terrible fighting, where far too many civilians, far too many children and women lost their lives. It's also to show solidarity to the Gazans in general, but also to the kids, the children who lost their lives, who were injured.
The ambassadors of the European Union made an inspection tour of the wounded during the recent Israeli aggression at Gaza's Shifa Hospital.
We briefed the European delegation on the humanitarian situation in Gaza and the dire condition of hospitals. The delegation also visited the patients and those who were injured during the recent Israeli military aggression. We also told them about the lack of medicines and hospital supplies because of the Israeli blockade.
The brief visit by the European diplomats comes at a time when the people of Gaza are suffering under a tight Israeli blockade that has been in place since 2007. Most Gazans rely on handouts to survive, and many of them are unemployed.
It's clear that many more people fell below the poverty line. Unemployment rate has significantly increased. Health and education problems have become even more problematic.
Palestinians and human rights groups have repeatedly slammed the European countries for their failure to take an action aimed at ending Israeli violations against the besieged territory. Many here believe that the visit by the European diplomats will not improve the situation for the people of Gaza, given Israel's impunity and the failure of the international community to hold the regime accountable for its crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
1 year has passed since the fall of Kabul to the Taliban and the end of the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. Since then, the country has been facing major problems which have caused serious difficulties for the Afghan people. Ahmadullah Baghwan reports.
Mid-August this year marked the one-year anniversary of the Taliban takeover of Afghanistan and the U.S. massive withdrawal from the country after 2 decades of military presence. The last year U.S.-led evacuation turned violent and tragic, during which many Afghan people lost their lives. Sports champion Muhammad John, who was shot dead at the Kabul airport, was one of the victims. His parents blame the U.S. for the tragic incident and are seeking compensation for the loss of their boy.
The U.S. and its allies are 100% to blame for the martyrdom of our beloved ones at the airport because they invited people and gave them hope of getting them out of Afghanistan. The U.S. not only did not provide the people with security, but also opened fire on them. They killed and injured at least 400 people, including my son. We are waiting for compensation from those who committed the crime.
The U.S. two-decade invasion of Afghanistan ended with the withdrawal of the last U.S. troops from Kabul last year. However, Afghans say Washington has started another war against them, a dangerous economic war. Since the Taliban's return to power on August 15, 2021, the U.S. has frozen nearly $9 billion in Afghanistan foreign reserves and cut off major international funding. The sanctions have pushed Afghanistan's economy to the brink of collapse, with 97% of Afghans live in poverty. Afghan people and international bodies have been calling for the release of funds so that the country could cope with the ongoing humanitarian crisis.
The impacts of the U.S. seizure of Afghan assets have not been less than the damages of their 20-year war. When the U.S. sanctions were imposed on Afghanistan, the fragile economy started to shrink. Banking system crashed and people went out of cash. The money they had on their hands lost its value. Today, 1 year on, the conditions are deepening, so the U.S. and the international communities are obliged to unfreeze the assets and let the flow of aid to the country.
Meanwhile, violence and bloodshed have continued under the Taliban. The country saw a rise in deadly attacks against the Shia community last year, mostly carried out by the Daesh terrorist group. 1 year into the Taliban's return to power, Afghans are still grappling with multiple crises. However, they are happy that the U.S. occupation of their country has ended. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
In Tunisia, a new constitution has come into force. This after the country's electoral commission approved the final results of last month's referendum. The commission says almost 95% of the votes were in favor of the new constitution. The turnout, however, was low. Around 31% of the electorate took part. The new constitution expands President Kais Saied's powers while reducing those of the parliament. Opponents of the president say the new constitution will unravel Tunisia's democratic gains from 2011. Sajid and his supporters have said that the political system needs to change to save Tunisia from years of stagnation and political paralysis. Meanwhile, Kenya is bracing for a legal battle as opposition leader Raila Odinga has challenged the presidential election results, which saw incumbent Deputy President William Ruto as a winner.
What we saw yesterday was a travesty and a blatant disregard of the Constitution and the laws of Kenya by Mr. Chebukati and a minority of IEBC commissioners. The law does not vest in the chairperson the powers of a dictator to rule the IEBC unilaterally.
Odinga, who was in his fifth bid for presidency, refused to concede, saying the country's democracy has suffered a setback. He also vowed to pursue legal means to challenge the decision of the Election Commission. Ruto was declared a victor with some 50.5% of the ballot, but more than half of the commission refused to endorse him. Moments before the announcement, scuffles broke out in the vote tally center. Odinga's strongholds, namely the cities of Kisumu and Nairobi, protesters also battled the police and burned tires overnight. The East African country was hoping for an orderly transition of power after almost a decade under President Uhuru Kenyatta, but concerns about vote rigging linger as such disputes in the past have spiraled into bloodshed. The last French soldier has been expelled from Mali, ending nearly a decade of military disaster and humanitarian catastrophe in the African country. The new government in Bamako has refused to even allow a French ambassador to return, causing many to wonder if the era of French neo-colonialism has begun its ending. Ramin Mazahari reports.
The last French soldiers have left Mali after being expelled by Bamako following 9 years of unpopular war, which has left Mali one of the poorest countries in the world. 2.5 million refugees have been created, thousands of civilians were killed, and the politicians who initially colluded with Paris, widely accused of corruption, were ousted by popular anti-French protests in 2020.
Malians have been dying for 9 years. Things have only gotten worse. It has spread to Niger, Burkina Faso, Mauritania, and elsewhere. After 9 years, this hasn't worked, and Malians want results. However, when Malians made their revolution, France criticized and opposed it.
The roots of the Mali conflict run deep, but they all feature French aggression. In 2011, Nicolas Sarkozy illegally dropped 40 tons of arms to help overthrow the Socialist People's Libyan Arab Republic led by Muammar Gaddafi. Those arms spread to northern Mali, where the nomadic Tuaregs used them in their conflict with southern Mali, which has existed ever since imperialist France drew Mali's irregular bowtie-shaped borders. Paris alleged the Tuaregs were religious radicals, and in 2013, François Hollande invaded Mali prior to receiving the approval of the United Nations. Many allege that uranium deposits, which keep French nuclear power cheap, gold mines and their desire to maintain the neo-colonial system known as France-Afrique were the primary motivations for a war which would be dubbed France's Afghanistan.
Many of France's former colonies gained their independence in the 1950s, but since 1960, France has had more than 50 military interventions in Africa.
France has been completely wrong about so many things, and especially the times we now live in. This is a multipolar world, and neocolonialism has failed. Africa no longer wants France and the West as their only ally and as their tutors. Africa has changed, and we will choose our own partners and our own destiny.
The war killed 59 French soldiers. But French imperialism in Mali was cited repeatedly as justification in terror attacks in France, which cost hundreds of lives. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Sri Lanka's government says it will not extend a state of emergency imposed to control anti-government protests as the circumstances have stabilized. Emergency regulations allow troop and police to arrest and detain suspects for long periods. The state of emergency has been widely criticized by rights groups. It allows the president to make regulations and limit the freedoms of citizens without judicial review. The country's new president invoked such a rule shortly after his predecessor fled the country and resigned last month when thousands of protesters overran his official residence. The country has seen months of protests over acute shortages of food, fuel, and medicine. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
It's clear that AIPAC has its work cut out for it in boosting its preferred candidates in democratic primaries. Under the circumstances, it makes good sense to use Republican mega-donors' money and make no mention of the Israeli regime if AIPAC wants to raise money and effectively engage democratic voters. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ellie Clifton, investigative journalist. This article is published under the heading, AIPAC's New Strategy. Spend millions on elections. Don't mention Israeli regime. Here's more. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee's announcement late last year that it would launch a super PAC, the United Democracy Project, and endorse candidates sent shockwaves through foreign policy and advocacy communities. AIPAC had long refrained from engaging in electoral politics, preferring instead to lobby members of Congress to support maintaining the Zionist regime's nearly $4 billion in annual military and other aid from the United States. But now that the Super PAC is active, raising over $27 million and running ads to support or oppose Democratic primary candidates for the 2022 midterms, it's becoming clear that UDP's fundraising and spending strategy is raise money from hawkish Trump supporting GOP big donors and spend on ads to benefit Democratic candidates who won't question U.S. policy towards the U.S. biggest foreign military aid recipient. Curiously, though, the ads paid for by UDP, affiliated with the largest pro-Israel group in the country, don't mention the group's central issue, the Israeli regime. And that might be because AIPAC's central issue, the Israeli regime, has a remarkably little salience with U.S. voters. Polling conducted between 2010 and 2020 by the J Street, a Democratic Party-aligned group often at odds with AIPAC on a host of issues, reveals that Jewish voters, a demographic often expected to prioritize candidates' views on the Israeli regime, place an extremely low priority on Israel-related issue in elections. In a decade of polling, J Street found that the Zionist regime was a top two voting issue for between 4 and 10% of Jewish voters. In June, AIPAC ranked Democrats and earned extensive coverage in Jewish American and Israeli news outlets by endorsing 37 Republicans who voted against certifying President Joe Biden's election victory. AIPAC defended its decision to endorse the candidates to run campus at the Jewish Telegraph Agency. As a single-issue organization, we remain focused on our mission of building bipartisan support in Congress to strengthen the U.S.-Israel relationship, AIPAC spokesperson Marshall Whitman told campus. But AIPAC's Super PAC didn't seem to get that message. Their ads don't mention the Israeli regime, AIPAC's single issue, and explicitly made an issue of the contested election in an ad boosting Michigan State Senator Adam Holyer. When Donald Trump tried to throw out Detroit's presidential vote, Adam Holyer fought alongside Governor Whitmer to stop him, said an ad supporting Holyer in August 2nd Democratic primary for Michigan 13th District. Holyer lost the primary, but the ad revealed the cynical opportunism behind AIPAC's electoral strategy that leads the organization to endorse candidates who oppose certifying the election results while running ads promoting another candidate's work to certify the election, all while avoiding mention of the single issue that qualifies candidates from both sides of the contested election to earn AIPAC support. Last week, AIPAC PAC Director Merlin Rosenthal and United Democracy Project CEO Rob Basin answered questions about their electoral strategy from Jewish Insider. Rosenthal said their campaign work is allowing us to clearly define who is and who is not pro-Israel. Unquote. When asked about the Israeli regime not playing a significant role in AIPAC's campaign messaging, Basin responded, I would just say about that, first of all, the issues that UDP has focused on have been the issues that are foremost on the minds of voters. That being said, I think the views of the candidates on the U.S.-Israel relationship have been made clear on their websites and their position papers in their voting records. Unquote. Perhaps the most telling aspect of UDP's work has been where the group raises and spends its money. Two of UDP's biggest individual funders are Home Depot co-founder Bernard Marcus and hedge fund manager Paul Singer. both contributed $1 million to the UDP Super PAC. Both are Trump backers and Republican Party mega donors, regularly contributing millions of dollars to Republican candidates in each election cycle. That's in sharp contrast to where UDP spends its money, Democratic primaries. UDP's decision to influence Democratic primaries in order to defeat incumbents deemed insufficiently pro-Israel, with funds partially originating from Republican megadonors while actively avoiding mention of the group's organizing principle, the belief that America's partnership with Democratic ally, the Israeli regime, benefits both countries, may be a symptom of the Democratic Party's drift away from unconditional support for the Zionist regime. The UDP did not respond to a request for comment about why their campaign ads avoid mention of the Israeli regime. Only 0.5% of Democrats listed the Zionist regime as their first choice when asked to name the two countries that you think are the most important allies of the United States today, according to a University of Maryland survey conducted in March. Only 0.9% listed the Israeli regime as their second choice. The most popular choices by Democrats were the UK and Canada. Among Republicans, 20% listed the Zionist regime as their first choice selection and 9.3% listed the Israeli regime as their second choice. With those starkly contrasting numbers, it's clear that AIPAC has its work cut out for it in boosting its preferred candidates in Democratic primaries. Under the circumstances, it makes good sense to use Republican megadonors' money and make no mention of the fake regime of Israel if AIPAC wants to raise money and effectively engage Democratic voters.
Food for thought.
Salam, and let us begin the day with a thought-stimulating saying from the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace upon him. The faithful must certainly desire to meet his Lord righteously. I do not deem death other than felicity, and life among the unjust other than suffering and boredom.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z, an introduction into Husseini lifestyle. Today's lesson, braveness of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. And in today's lesson, we are talking about the braveness of Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam. No personality was braver. No personality was determined and more valiant than the personality of Al-Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Al-Imam Hussein is seen throughout all the stages of the history of humanity because his eminence on the day of Karbala was in such a position that the intellects are perplexed and minds are bewildered at it. All the minds were bewildered, all people were surprised of how this particular eminent, this particular Imam was. Imam Hussein had a very surprising position in the land of Karbala. The generations venerate his memory and regard his bravery with absolute astonishment. Everyone was astonished about his personality at the time, and people have considered his valor higher to that of the well-known valor of his father. He was braver than his father was. He's considered to be braver than his father was, considering and looking at the fight that he took, looking at the stand that he took in the land of Karbala. People could easily consider that he was much braver than his father was at the time, because his father faced so many battles, of course, with braveness and everything, but not a battle resembles the battle of Karbala. So his cowardly enemies were shocked by the strength of his determination and the aim, because the Imam did not stay back. He had that type of valor, the type of braveness that everybody never really understood. Everybody was shocked, including the enemies. They were so much shocked with his braveness. And this is one of the very main important traits that we learn from the life of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Why is my heart set on fire when I hear your name?
السلام على عليك يا أبا عبد الله
وعلى أرواح
النبي. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. We're talking about the braveness of Al-Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam. In today's topic, the braveness of Imam Al-Hussein alayhi salam really is something for us to reflect. When we look upon the happening of Karbala, the fight of Karbala, we realize that he was such a personality that stood braver every time when he was in front of his enemy. His cowardly enemies were definitely shocked by the strength of this particular personality, his determination, Al-Imam Hussein's determination and aim, because the Imam never stepped back due to the continuous horrible strikes that befell him, one after the other. They were fighting him, sending every type of weapon against him, but he never stood back. And the more the difficulties increased and the calamities intensified, the more steadfast he became and the more his face shone. And, you know, when all his followers and his Ahlul Bayt were martyred, all the armies consisting of 30,000 mercenaries, according to some reports, surrounded the Imam alayhi salam from all sides. But you see, the Imam, though the lone survivor, attacked the hordes with ferocity of a wolf attacking a herd of goats, and the enemies despaired in fear and trepidation. They were fleeing in front of him in all directions, and he was like a firm mountain, and he faced the swords from all sides in such a manner that there was no sort of laxity on his part. He did not care for death with all his bravery. Sayyid Haider says, when he alone, Al-Imam Hussein, faced a particular group, all groups were terrified before him. His spear was on his fingertips as if they had made their swords for that same purpose. The sword was married to the self, and its door was death, and its henna, the dust and soil of the battlefield. Thank you so much for listening. Till next episode, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode and another lesson, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Better friends than you, but anyone stay here won't be alive tomorrow. You can save yourself tonight and go. A deep silence filled the air.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Stunning scenes in Spain as the last supermoon of the year illuminates the night sky amid fireworks and fairs marking the start of festivities for a public holiday. In Malaga, fireworks left the sky a mix of colors against the bright moon. There was also a spectacle of drones that lightened the sturgeon moon. Locals in the Canary Islands also celebrated the three-day holiday by lighting up a Ferris wheel as the full moon beamed beautifully in the sky. If the moon is within 10% of its closest distance to Earth at the moment of full moon, it is called a supermoon. The supermoon has various hues and appears bigger and brighter than when the moon is at its farthest point from Earth. Have you ever heard of fighting nature with nature? Well, that's what the San Francisco metro system in the U.S. did to stop pigeons from overrunning the place. The station has hired a hawk as the new guard to patrol the area. Pac-Man is a 5-year-old Harris's hawk who has taken up the perch at the station. In terms of experience, he is pretty new, as he finished training only 9 months ago. The station recently renovated its building, installing netting and spikes to prevent pigeons from nesting. But these birds still seem to find their way to hang around. With the Falconer Force, Ricky Ortiz and his hawk were hired this summer to keep the pigeons at bay.
So a typical day is we get here, we make our round, we start off down in the bottom inside the facility, making sure there's no pigeons hanging out in there. And then we work our way up here to the platforms and just check the ledges and the roof and make sure that they're not trying to sneak in on us and keep them out. And he does a pretty good job of that.
The team patrols 3 days a week, and Pac-Man is allowed to swoop in and scare any pigeons sitting around. The Falconer says less than half of the pigeons left after the first week of Pac-Man flying and establishing the territory. Commuters and station managers say they also noticed the difference. The Falconer says he usually keeps his feathery friend happy on the job by giving him snacks throughout the day. This also encourages the hawk not to feast on the pigeons and local rodents.
technology helps transform the global food production system and mitigates its impact on the environment. China's autonomous region of Tibet is turning barren land into fertile one using greenhouse technology. Once removed, Beinan County is now the largest off-season vegetable supplier in Tibet. The region has taken advantage of its highland conditions to develop a state-of-the-art agricultural structure. Beinong has now more than 2,200 modern vegetable greenhouses and nearly 12,000 hectares of planting area, some built at unimaginable altitude. But one cannot deny the role of railways and highway transport for making this county a hub for organic vegetables. The income of locals has also been significantly improved, and they are now living a happy and prosperous life. If you're a private collector of wild animals, there is good news for you. A Pakistani zoo is auctioning off a dozen lions due to a lack of money to feed them and a space to house them. Lahore Safari Zoo currently has so many big cats that they have to take turns accessing paddocks. Officials say auctioning them will free up space and also reduce expenses. Zoo is currently housing 29 lions. The lions auctioned this week will be between 2 to 5 years of age. Each big cat is estimated to fetch around 150,000 Pakistan rupees. That's not too much, as some zookeepers claim. Even conservationists have expressed anger over auctioning lions to private collectors instead of transferring them to other zoos. Happy news for zoo-goers in Nicaragua. Two adorable baby tapirs are born at a country's national zoo south of Managua, adding attractions to the visitors. Two endangered tapirs, a male and a female, were born hours apart at the weekend. In a video shared by the zoo, one of the newborns is seen suckling and walking near her mother. The director of the zoo says the babies are yet to be named but are in perfect health. Tapirs inhabit jungle and forest regions of South and Central America, with one species inhabiting Southeast Asia. They look something like pigs with trunks, but they are actually related to horses and rhinos. Nicaragua launched a project that seeks to conserve this animal in danger of extinction due to hunting and the destruction of natural habitat.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Now we'll take you to mind-riddled French island, Chazoms, which is emerging from the ruins and gradually turning into workers' paradise. Chazombre, close to the port city of Saint-Malo, has an amazing landscape but remains uninhabited as it saw a devastating bombardment by the Allies during the World War II. The Nazi-occupied island was victim of the most bombings per square meter. Known as Martyred and Forbidden Island, it was opened only in 2018 after extensive demining efforts allowed the opening of a marked path. Now, every year, thousands of day trippers make the short boat journey, marveling at the spectacular maritime views and flourishing wildlife there. The safe area still makes up just 3% of the island, but it lets visitors wander between rusty cannons and bunkers. Some workers say they hope the trail will be lengthened to allow a complete tour of the island.
Africa is taking back some of its greatest treasures stolen by the British back in the 19th century. The Horniman Museum in London has agreed to return the artifacts to Nigeria. These are 72 relics, which include 12 highly treasured brass plaques known as the Benin Bronzes. The bronzes are a group of several thousand metal plaques and sculptures that decorated the royal palace of the once mighty kingdom of Benin since the 16th century. These artifacts were looted from a region in modern-day Nigeria in a British military incursion. They later ended up in museums in Europe and the U.S. African countries have been fighting to recover works pillaged by explorers and colonizers as Western institutions grapple with the cultural legacy of colonialism. The Jamtal Glacier in Austria has been losing around 1 meter of its surface annually. Scientists say the ice is a precious archive that is simply melting away and are surveying the area. Austrian mountain researchers say the glaciers contain an invaluable trove of ancient frozen leaves and twigs and other scientific treasures that can be lost forever. They say the time capsules, including the remote Jamtal Valley, are falling victim to climate change. In the 1990s, tourists found that 5,300-year-old mummy of Iceman near the same area. According to the international data, global warming has raised temperatures in Europe's highest mountains by nearly 2 degrees Celsius in the past 120 years. French rescuers are racing against time to save a beluga whale stranded in Seine River near Paris. The beluga was first spotted stuck between two locks in the river from Paris to the English Channel on Tuesday. Specialists say the animal is undernourished and is refusing food. Warm water is also worsening the health of this creature, which is normally seen near Norway, some 3,000 kilometers to the north. Rescuers say they have only up to 48 hours to save the whale. They are now looking at the possibility of taking the beluga out of the water, treating it, and eventually transferring it out to the sea.
There are many big restaurants with Michelin stars awarded based on their quality. But you will be amazed to know that an eatery located in a tiny village in Greenland also has this badge of honor, making it the world's most remote Michelin-starred restaurant. This eatery in the village, which is home to only 53 people, serves you what it gets from its immediate surroundings. Looking out over the chilly North Atlantic, customers taste a variety of local products, ranging from whale skin to an Arctic bird whose entire wing, including feathers, is on the plate. The restaurant is so remote that you can only reach there by boat through floating icebergs. The head chef says he forages for wild berries, flowers, and herbs every day since the menu largely includes local flavors.
Visitors and staff at a French zoo have celebrated the first birthday of twin pandas. The young bears were given a tasty treat of frozen cakes and other treats. As part of the event, 5 lucky visitors were also given the chance to participate in the celebrations behind the scenes with golden tickets. Other festivities included face painting and panda-themed activities. The baby pandas were born last August and now weigh 23 and 28 kilograms. They live with their mother at Zoo Parc de Bouval, where they have been on display since their arrival in 2021.
Many people develop deeper relationships with four-legged animals, treating them like their own kids. A Kenyan conservationist is one of them. 33-year-old Salome Lemercier has been a community ranger in Sierra Conservancy, Northern Kenya, since 2015. The mother of four is stationed at a rhino sanctuary and is in charge of protecting a male rhino named Loijipo. At just a few days old, Loijipo was abandoned by his mother, possibly due to her being spooked by something. After being cared for, he was returned to the sanctuary under surveillance in an attempt to rewild him. 3 years on, from his release into Sierra Wilderness, he is taking his time to carve out his territory, of course, with the help of Salome.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
America has conducted nearly 400 interventions since its founding, with more than a quarter in the last 30 years. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Nick Terse, writer. This article is published under the heading, Report Shows Post-9/11 Era, One of the Most Militarily Aggressive in U.S. History. Here's more. The United States has conducted nearly 400 military interventions since 1776, according to innovative research by scholars Sidita Kushi and Monica Duffy. Half of those conflicts and other uses of force, including displays and threats of force, as well as covert and other operations, occurred between 1950 and 2019, the last year covered in a new data set introduced by Kushi and Toft in a Journal of Conflict Resolution published earlier this week. More than a quarter of them have taken place since the end of the Cold War. The United States has carried out 34% of its 392 interventions against countries in Latin America and the Caribbean, 23% in East Asia and the Pacific region, 14% in West Asia and North Africa regions, and just 13% in Europe and Central Asia, according to a newly refined version of the Military Intervention Project, a venture of the Center for Strategic Studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. In addition to providing the most accurate count ever of U.S. military interventions, doubling the number of cases found in existing data while also employing rigorous sourcing methods, the MIP offers 200 variables that allow for complex analysis of drivers and outcomes of wars and other uses of force. Crucially, the writers of the report, the directors of Fletcher's School Center for Strategic Studies, found that U.S. interventions have increased and intensified in recent years, while the Cold War era and the period between 1868 to 1917 were the most militaristically active for the United States. The post-9/11 era has already assumed third position in all of the U.S. history. Unlike earlier eras in which displays and threats of force were employed, such posturing short of military violence has been absent in recent years. The United States, they found, has actually engaged in 30 interventions at level 4 usage of force or 5 war. Until the end of the Cold War, the U.S. military hostility was generally proportional to that of its rivals. Since then, the U.S. began to escalate its hostilities as its rivals de-escalated, marking the beginning of America's more kinetic foreign policy. This recent pattern of international relations, conducted largely through armed force, what experts has termed kinetic diplomacy, has increasingly targeted the West Asia-North Africa region. These regions have been both large-scale U.S. wars, as in Afghanistan and Iraq, and low-profile combating nations such as Burkina Faso, Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Chad, and Tunisia. The data incorporates confirmed covert operations and low-profile interventions by special operations forces, but a combination of U.S. government secrecy and the dataset's scrupulous sourcing standards guarantees that post-9/11 tally is an undercount, according to experts. Recently, for example, it is revealed that the existence of low-profile proxy war programs run across Africa, the West Asia region, and the Indo-Pacific region, while experts say that the Pentagon has likely used the secretive 127E authority to carry out combat beyond the scope of any authorization for use of military force or permissible self-defense in violation of the Constitution. Such highly classified operations may evade capture in the MIP data set. While 127E programs in Somalia and Yemen, for example, overlap with known U.S. military interventions, other uses of the authority, such as in Egypt and Lebanon, may not. The same goes for even lesser-known authorities like Section 1202, which provides support to foreign irregular forces aimed at near-peer competitors. As the data set is further developed and refined, experts hope that it will allow for more nuanced understanding of the conditions that cause the United States to launch military interventions and the effects on the U.S. and the nations it targets, including the economic and human toll and inadvertent outcomes. What they ask were the longer-term cost and unintended consequences of the interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq, and how did that intervention influence U.S. engagements in Libya, Syria, and Yemen? The answers, they hope, will lead to improved data and, ultimately, a better U.S. foreign policy. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and welcome to the latest edition of Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied